picking up with Mike Webb, Western Lane Ambulance District Board Member, and Matt House, Ops Chief. And let's talk a little bit about how the individuals are paid for their different jobs that they do there. Now, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, where the pay scale was versus, you know, other communities when we were, before we went on the air with this. Give me an idea of, you know, apples to apples. I mean, you know, obviously you've got privatization companies, which is different, but then you've got, you know, union companies that serve large communities. Tell me a little bit about how that works, Mark.
Well, the pay scales for the private entities, the one that we have in hand, is for AMR up in the Portland area, and AMR is represented by the Teamsters. So they negotiated a contract back in 2018, and AMR the employees won a significant increase because apparently they were being underpaid, or at least that's the decision by that. And their entry-level employees, as of this year, starting employee, just a real basic, is paid $41,000 a year. And step increases will take that all the way up to $50,719 for an entry-level or basic intermediate EMT after 12 years. Their paramedic level, which the vast majority, I would say 90% of our employees are at paramedic level, or at least of the full-time employees are at paramedic level, are paid from their base pay is $60,991 and goes up to $84,684 after year 12. That's AMR's pay scale. Western Lane Ambulance pay scale, our basic paramedics are paid, and we typically hire intermediates and paid from a level of intermediates start at $45,893 and they top out after the sixth step. And it's not an annual step, it's a step to criteria. If they meet certain criteria, they get the step increase. They top out at $61,518. Now, this is base pay, doesn't include any overtime. Our paramedics, which are higher trained and worth more, they're better at their job in general just because of their education level and their experience. But they're paid $62,207 as an entry first year, and they top out at $81,689 base pay. But we also have supervisors and captains. Our supervisors are now called captains, so they've flipped around a little bit. And their pay scale has changed a little bit more because they get incented to have that supervisory spot. And ours are paid, the starting level Western Lane Ambulance Captain Supervisor, $71,538 is their base pay. But they top out at $93,942. Our captains have average seniority of 26 years with the district. So they're very experienced. They also earn overtime. And if they have an opportunity to work additional shifts, which they can, they can earn significant additional monies. I think there's a number cited at $122,000 a year. I don't know which year that was referencing, and I haven't looked at anybody's individual pay stub, but I'm sure it's possible to get up to that level. The flip side is, how do you overcome the overtime? And the only way to do that is, frankly, the demand for services is high enough that we need to staff that level. So the only alternative is to hire more people. And if we hire more people, at what level does it make sense economically? Right now, it's still more economical for the district to hire or to pay overtime than it is to hire additional crew at this point.
Well, because there's a lot of things to consider when you have a new employee, like their PERS contributions, their, you know, unemployment, all that stuff that goes into considering a new employee.
A fully loaded employee plus the apparatus that you have to provide them. So you're thinking about, what's the choice that we're doing economics? We're trying to manage the money of the district as best we can. There is a balancing point where overtime doesn't become or is no longer the economic choice. And then you add additional staff.
What about overtime? I mean, you know, because obviously there's, you know, you think about you've got a certain amount of staff. Overtime can be very taxing, especially if someone's, you know, having a week where you've got significant amount of calls coming in there. I mean, are there restrictions or guidelines as to how much overtime someone can get?
Yeah, so the staffing model that we currently run is a 48 hours on, 96 off. And per contract agreed upon with the union, that is the max allowable that we'll do. However, there are occasions and emergency situations that we would extend that to 72 hours in a row and having 3 days off with 72 hours off. Very seldom do we try to do that. We try to keep it to the 48-96 model because of the, you know, safety concerns. But we also have many, many other safety mechanisms in place internally. So if somebody's tired, fatigued, that we can actually get them rest so they can get rest, get back into the game. When we're talking about overtime, vacations, sick, disabilities, everything factors into this, which would create an overtime shift. So an overtime shift, yeah, of course, is 1.5 times the normal rate, so it is more money. But we are very conscious on how we do this. We've also developed very deeply within our system by board direction 5-6 years ago. Said, you know, they, at the time I wasn't a chief officer. They said, Matt, we need you to handle this as the interim. Look at developing our district. That's exactly what we did. We have a part-time list of about 16 employees, so they fill some of those voids to help deflect the overtime costs.
But is there anything in there that says, okay, Captain XYZ has 48 on, and you need someone to fill that other, you know, 24-hour shift? Does that captain get first priority in choosing that, or do you use your part-time?
No, it goes by a rotational list. The first four positions are guaranteed to the union, but then we actually have 6 positions that we fill in a current day. Today, we have a position that we haven't filled because we're working together with more closely with the fire department so we can work together, and that's the whole goal, is working together for our community. If a shift comes open, it goes by a rotation list. You know, if first of all somebody has the ability to sign up for an extra overtime shift, and that's kind of what we've done, is like, you want to work an extra shift, we have an extra shift. We're realizing it's a convenience because they normally work 240 hours a month, so they're 240 hours away from their family. So if they're wanting to pick up another shift, so it goes by rotation list, first come, first serve, and go down the list. So for an example, I took an overtime shift yesterday. Another one comes up, you would be first on the list to say yes or no to the overtime shift, and we would continue to go down that list until we fill the position. If we were unable to fill the position by voluntary overtime, then it would turn into mandatory overtime where we draft somebody on a list again. You're number one on the draft list. Can you come to work? Do you have an undue hardship? Yes, I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.
So, but the first four on that would be the ones that would be primary.
The bargain, yeah.
And then because of the union deal.
Yep. And by obligation to the ambulance service area, we were required to provide 2 ALS ambulances to respond at any time. So, and that ties into the bargaining agreement that we have those 4 positions always filled. The 5th position we create, and it's the district's right to how we can fill that position, whether it be by full-time or part-time, and we do fill it a lot by part-time as well to deflect overtime costs. We created a 6th position. Again, this goes back to Director Webb's, you know, hey, we need to develop our system. And so we did, and we created a 6th position. We call it a recruit and retention position so we can develop our system and newer employees in that realm.
Yeah, that was a funny thing. There was an employee that was requesting a special modification policy so that she could move out of area. And Matt was promoting that. And the question came from the board to Matt and said, okay, well, how are we going to manage the callbacks? Because our concern about having employees out of area has, how do they respond if we have a crisis? And Matt says, I want to develop a farm team. I want to develop the volunteers. And he, working through the fire department, he has developed the farm team. He's done a fantastic job. And these employees are the people that are coming in and filling in the part-time roles when we can. Now, the contract requires certain people come in at certain times. And the rotation is based upon the first 4 are union people. And then we can have the ability to work with some people and manage the staff a little bit better. But Matt's ability to come in and develop these people has given us more arrows in our quiver, and we have been able to save some money. And I think the last couple of years, we've seen the fruits of that with the way the overtime has been managed. Our staffing has better matched the demand at the district at the time. And we're starting to see cash surplus at the end of the year rather than a cash deficit, and showing that we are actually managing the monies the way we should be so that we can continue our operation at the same level going forward.
And I would add to that, even with the Sentinel last 2 months being higher than any call volume in the last 2 months, we've been able to manage this very well.
So you have the idea, and it's been talked about for quite some time, the idea of a potential or possible merger somewhere down the road. Obviously, the fire district can't necessarily expand, and the Western Lane Ambulance can't necessarily contract. How do you foresee, if that were something that were to happen, that working in the current model you have now?
I think it'd be really easy. We basically would, if we became one district, you still have an ASA for the ambulance services that we provide ambulance services in other districts or other, so Mapleton, Swiss Home, Deadwood, we're still up and active in that area. And Sunnyside Valley Fire continues to provide fire protection services in the same area it is. You have a blended tax rate. So in the tax areas where it's only Western Lane is the only thing we provide, they'd see tax at the current level. They wouldn't see any change. Sunnyside Valley would see in the area where they are, they would see the same tax rate. But the moving to one model is an interesting thing, and it's up for discussion. We're into the point right now where we're considering putting all employees under one, and we're discussing that. And one of the main things that we're trying to do is make sure that we can show a proper accounting to the people of the community of how the monies are being spent, make sure that Western Lane Ambulance monies and Sunnyside Valley Fire monies can easily be tracked and the services that those taxes provide can be tracked. We're working on that, and we're stepping into strategic planning here in the next month or two so that we can get the community's pulse on it and make sure everybody is on board with whatever direction we decide, but no direction has been chosen.
I think we got a good feel from the community's response. We sent out the poll through, 300 random phone calls went out for a survey, and overwhelmingly the results were, depending on how the questions were asked, 77% to 86% of the respondents were in favor of a merger, and then 79% were against privatization or for-profit ambulance services in the area. The other thing that was a driving force to have more clarity with this poll was there was about 55% of the people that thought we were the same district already. So that kind of says we're doing the job and we're doing it well. We're operationally hitting all the marks that people, when they call 911 and services show up, they're getting the job done.
Yeah, the thing to me is when you look at typical fire services are waiting for an emergency to happen, and they don't have a lot of stuff to do in an interim time until something goes. So you're paying for people to be in reserve and waiting for stuff. Adding the opportunity for them to work with emergency medical services allows them something to do and a better use of taxpayer money. And by considering a merger, what we can do through something like that is potentially offer the community a better service for the same tax dollars. And that's the whole intention. How can we better serve the people? How can we coordinate services better? How can we make sure your dollars are going in the right direction and being spent the right way so that you're getting the services that you deserve, that you're paying for?
I also look at it another way. In an operational standpoint, when we look at both the entities, Sunnyside Valley Fire and Western Lane Ambulance District, we're on an island, meaning that we're on an island not as a fear tactic, but we're on an island that we have to be self-sustainable, that we have to be relying on our own agencies to provide the services as needed. And Western Lane Ambulance is able to provide 90% of our call volume. We're hitting the marks every time. The 10%, the balloon effect or surge volumes, we're able to work cooperatively with the fire department to hit those marks even better. So we have to be self-sustainable in our area because we have mutual aid partners that will come into our area, but that takes about 20, 30 minutes for them to get in to help out on a bigger event. We are self-sustainable. We are self-efficient.
And that's something I have concerns with a for-profit model is if we contracted with a for-profit to come in and provide emergency services in the area, what happens if you have an event up in Swiss Home Deadwood area, Mapleton area, where their volunteer fire departments are pure volunteer fire departments? They don't have budget for our resources to act and provide emergency medical services at a level that the people deserve. They rely upon Western Lane. What happens if the staff, because of a for-profit model, doesn't have enough ambulances reserved, and they have to pull ambulances from Eugene or from Coos Bay or wherever to help cover the area. What happens in their response? Are we putting the districts upriver into a position where they really can't respond? And are, what's happened to the people up there? I don't know if that's the type of service that, at least blindly, that we should go into and think this is something that would be an advantage to the people.
One of the things that I heard thrown around was the idea that, you know, because of the taxes and because of the levy and because of the, you know, payment per service, that people are getting charged, quote, three times for services. Confirm or dispel that?
Well, it's you pay your taxes to make sure services are available. You don't pay for that actual service until the service is provided. So paying for the typical household well under $200 a house, $200 a year for taxes to make sure those services are here is a good thing. And it offsets some of the people who can't pay. But in that particular tax bill that was presented in the advertisements, I found it interesting. The person was a Medicare person, if you look at it. So the billing was roughly $1,850 for the bill. Medicare paid $500. They were billed something, or they were presented with something that said they were charged a $250 deductible charge for an out-of-service provider. And I really want to question, did they go back and ask the billing services or their insurance company if we really were out of area? And it looked to me like there may have been an error on that bill that possibly they shouldn't have paid anything for at all. But the taxes, it's like we pay for schools. I don't use the schools at this point, but we pay to have it there because it benefits the community. And by paying for emergency services in the community, you're helping the value of your house, especially the quality of the emergency services that we have. You're paying for the community in general to be a more self-sustaining community and be able to help the community rise above and be a... We pay for police, but hopefully we don't use them. Yeah, we pay for police.
And another way that our district helps with the taxpayers when we talk about this, yes, the original levy and then the operation levy and then the profits that we do potentially make all go into the fund. So if somebody claims a hardship that are unable to pay that $250 deductible, realizing that they pay taxes, it is waived. It's just a matter of asking the question. We also have the program LifeMed, which is automatically waives the deductible as well. So there's a lot of information that is out there that we invite everybody to come talk to Chief Schick, myself, and Dina, our office manager, to educate that, you know, it may appear that it's three bills, but it's in reality, it's not. There's other options. Any hardship that comes across my desk for request of financial aid, most likely when they're taxpayers, it's denied, you know, that we don't, you know.
But is there an education out there available for people to know about that waiver? I mean, obviously, you know, are people automatically aware? I mean, I guess they are now because we're talking about it, but...
It goes through our billing department, and we outsource our billing department to system design, which most agencies now outsource their billing department. It's just more feasible and economical. And I would say another taxpayer savings because of what we're doing. We don't have to have an internal coder billing going down that pathway. But there's things set up with system design that we've worked at. If it is a taxpayer, they know not to essentially send a bill. If they do send a bill and then something comes up in question, it usually comes to me. And then if it's something over $1,500, the board has directed me to bring it to the board to approve the financial hardship or not approve it. And you can attest, I don't think we've ever denied a financial hardship when it comes into our taxpayers.
There's that, and I don't think we've turned anybody over to collections since I've been with the district.
Yeah.
That's a common tactic by for-profits, but we don't turn people over to collections.
There's zero people in collections.
We try to work with people to make the payment. LifeMed's probably our best education as to how you can offset the payment. But... it's on a case-by-case basis, and if people ask, typically we can work with them one way or the other. But that particular one was interesting, and it seems to be intentionally misleading the public that you're paying for something that you're not getting, but you are benefiting from having an ambulance service available, whether you use it or not, because it provides lower interest and lower insurance billing. So, for example, fire billing, or if you have a good quality fire department, your insurance rates are different. It doesn't mean you're using the fire department. So,
right. That's the difference between having a, if you have a fire hydrant like within a couple hundred feet of your house, it's different than being rural and not having any fire.
Yeah. So these services are things that honestly, I think that's misleading. But I believe that the ambulance and I believe the fire in conjunction, the emergency service that we provide in this community help the community dramatically and help the value of the community, same as good quality schools would.
All right, final question. I just want to talk about this for a second. We're getting in the 40-minute mark here. One of the opponents of the levy was talking about how there was a point in time, I guess, when you and he and Chief Schick and Larry Farnsworth and Chief Schick were in together for a budgetary meeting or something like that, and there were some notices of finances and how they could be reworked. And apparently I was told you were all on the same page at one point on, you know, what the situation was. And then I think you mentioned earlier about how you looked at it again and maybe some changes were made. Was that kind of what happened?
Well, really, I think what Chief and Larry were looking at prior to going into negotiations, we were looking at a trend based upon 2018-2019 year-end information that showed us as a cash deficit. We were bleeding more cash than we were bringing in. And the trend wasn't good, and we're also looking at additional expenses coming down the road. So the forecast called for the need to make some cuts. And the board at that time said, this is the position that we want to be in going into negotiations. A funny thing happened during negotiations is we got our year-end information. And our year-end information didn't show the economic hardship that we believed we had going into it. In fact, it showed a surplus, a significant surplus, if I remember the audit right, like $500,000.
And that was due mainly to call volume increases?
Volume increases and the changes in the way that we were putting our people in overtime, the fifth and sixth positions that we were working with. Our ability to manage those positions a little bit better was one of the main differences, management.
Matt, that was after Matt came in and started, or was about the same time?
Well, Matt had been in, but this is after Chief Schick actually became Chief Schick and became permanent Chief Schick. Prior to that, we had a revolving door. After Henry Hamp passed away, we had two or three interim people, and then we had Jim Langborg, who was coming in and trying to manage the books of Western Lane as the first-time person going in to see that. It takes a little bit of time to learn what was going on and learn how you can affect the district. And by the time Chief Schick got here, most of that stuff had been figured out. And between Matt and Chief, the management of the dollars has been much, much better. So, frankly, we're in a fiscal position that wasn't the same as what we thought it was when we went into negotiations. So the economic argument that we had to balance a budget or we had to take roughly $500,000 out of the employee's payroll at that point in time was still held tightly by Larry, but it wasn't there. We didn't have that. And the union agreed to freeze their wages for 2 years, and we've never had them do that.
But no cuts.
No cuts, but the freeze was amazing, and that saved us over projected increases dramatically.
And the financial position was completely different, like Mike said. And then as we got more information in and through the negotiation process, it was identified that there was no cuts really needed to happen, even for now or even financial forecasting. But even though that the employees said we'll do a freeze on our wages, it was great. But in the reality of it, the net position changed from the very beginning of negotiations. And what I appreciated about the board is that they realized this is changing. The numbers are different. We don't have to do cuts. We don't have to lay anybody off. We don't have to do 60% cuts to the staff. Let's maintain where we're at and reevaluate, you know, as we do every year. And then that essentially led to a 4-1 vote of the contract ratification.
We went all the way to mediation on the contract, trying to force something harder. The mediator said we didn't have an argument. Our attorney said we didn't have an argument for the economics that we were asking for. We got a significant concession from the union. They really worked with us to get ourselves, our financial ship going in the right direction. And in the future, if they continue to work with us in the same way, we're going to be healthy for a long time. I don't expect them to freeze their wages. I expect them to be paid for what they do. But we have to be able to afford it. and they see the numbers the same as we do. They also see the average pay, and they're negotiating based upon what the averages are. Some say that we're unique. We're an ambulance district, and there are no other ambulance districts that you can go out and say, this is our competitors. This is our competitors' wage scale. We truly should be comparing against publics, and the publics are typically fire paramedic blends. So you have districts like Corvallis and Albany and Springfield, Lane Rural. We're right in line with their pay scales and their benefit scales. We're in the same. In fact, our benefits, we might even be a little bit better because the employees pay a portion of their health insurance. That was a concession earned many years ago. The argument that they should be being paid $40,000 a year because that's what you pull up on Google if you get a national average for EMTs, I don't think applies to the employees the way that they are.
Mentioned earlier, especially you've got some with 20, some 20 plus years service already.
Average, close to 30, yeah. Average is 13 years for the staff with the district. We have the economies that you gain by having an experienced district. You have people that know the people, they know the typical medical conditions. They know the mapping. Where are places?
Well, I think the mapping would be an extreme benefit.
Definitely.
Versus bringing in people that are
outside.
It's response times. That's how we get there quicker.
And then dune calls, where you have sections of the dunes and how to behave in the dune area. Having people that are experienced in that realm, how do you put a price on that?
I want to thank you both. We are out of time for this. I think we got the majority of the information that I think you wanted out there. I think this is good stuff, and appreciate both you being here. Mike Webb, Matt House, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk with Public Works Director Mike Miller, Russ Pearson from Lane Community College, and the folks with FACE for the Winter Music Festival on the October edition of Our Town.